I printed out a few of those. Yeah, I finished things. I'm just sticking because there's not enough for one for everybody. Right, most people want to talk on it later.
Yeah, really interesting. Strange things.
Sorry?
Strange things. I thought I read them, but I read them again. And, Anyway, thank you for that. That's right. Yeah. Right.
Are you going to use the extra?
I'm going to use this one.
Okay.
And some other people will use
this one. Or because then we have to switch.
Sorry, I need to do this as well.
Yeah. Is there?
Good, that's fine. We can do that. Okay.
So we can
switch. Yeah, we'll switch back. Just switch it back.
Okay.
I'll make this work. Thank you. Well, I apologize for only being just in time. I'm afraid the working group chairs have a little tradition of gathering together to work out any things that need sorting out for the next meeting, and they wouldn't stop. I just had to walk away in the end. Sorry about that. And there'll be a short pause while I still get the next thing going. It's nice to see you here. We have what it says here is true, it's just that I can enlarge on it a little bit if I get a little bit more things going. Such as this one. As it says there, I believe we're just going through the easy bits first. This is the anti-spam working group, and anybody who thought it was something else is probably in the wrong place. Ascribe, it's Rob, thank you, it's good, from RIPE-NTC. Participants list are now optional, and unless anybody really wants to write down their name, I'm not going to do that. This agenda is almost the only one there is. If anybody already knows there's something they want to talk about that that won't come up there, then please do. There were some minutes from RIPE 52. If you haven't read them, this is not the time to start. If you have, then I'm sure you will have told me about it, and almost nobody nobody here did. I have one comment from outside this this group, but that's dealt with. Thank you. I know what that's about. Okay, what do I do? Press this button. That's where I want to get to. Just been looking at that, so that's not very interesting. Right, we have as a couple of priority items. You'd have seen there are some nice people from elsewhere who are going to present some things to us, and I've allowed that an hour. I'm already slightly behind time, but we basically just get on with it. Now, what I didn't resolve and haven't got back here in a few minutes to, who did I say was first? Pascal, would you speak first? In that case, thank you. Are you going to work from this PC?
Yes.
Okay, in that case, that's fine.
The presentation is on the PC.
It's on there. We'll find it. You'll probably find it more effective than I will.
Okay.
Oh, I'll press the wrong one, actually. Yeah. Okay. I can just briefly introduce Pascal. Pascal Manzano is from Enisa, which is located in Greece, and is a security agency, really, not in quite the technical sense, of the European Commission, European Community. Okay. And they have been doing some work, again, at the behest of the Commission, on security and, in particular, relations to spam and email abuse among ISPs. And that's what this is all about. Is there anything else you'd wish me to have said about you?
No, that's okay.
That's fine. Very brilliant. Can you talk into that, or would you like that as well?
No, it's okay, I think. Do you hear me? That's perfect. And hello, everybody. I am Pascal Manzano from Enisa. As Rodney said, Enisa is the European Network and Information Security Agency. We are located in Crete since last September. And I am in the security policy unit inside the technical department. As an agency, we use the work program where our tasks are defined. One of those tasks was to make a study on how provider implement the measure, the technical measure and the organizational measure described in the EU directive 2002/58, also called the Privacy and Electronic Communication Directive. The European Commission was wondering if they need to make an update or some change in this directive. Then they requested Enisa to give them early result. This is the reason why we produced two reports, one in February and the second in June. We made a questionnaire and we send it to national regulatory authorities and associations like ETNO, EuroISPA and other national provider associations. And we got around 100 answers. The directive, the European directive, are created by European institutions and they are transposed into national law by member states. And provider don't follow directly EU directive, but follow the national law in the country where they are operating. And the yellow ovals are actors who are influencing or in contact with the different bodies in the centers. Organizational measures. Well, the choice of measures implemented by provider varies a lot. Providing contact details or outline, it's a part of the core business for providers. Then adding security part for those service requires minor additional resources. In fact, it could appear strange that 18% of providers do not provide clear contact details. The lack of written guidance is common in IT area. Implementation are often seen as more important than documentation.
However, it is widely accepted among security professionals that guidance is a very important aspect, and we could see some guidance that could be useful for the user as a secure configuration of computer or usage of redundant connection. Remote technical assistance has a low rate, probably due to the fact that it needs a lot of deployment for the technology and also a training for the staff. But a question could be raised here, it's what happened in case of emergency? Most of the measures implemented by the provider are proactive measures, which is good, but in case of emergency, what happened? About technical measures. A closer look at the answers show that all the providers implement at least one measure. Most of the providers combine 3 to 5 measures, and few of them reply that they were putting in place all the measures that we proposed. Depending on the type of threats against the provider has to fight, they are using different measures. For example, a provider giving service like voice over IP would like to have a good quality of service and will favor traffic shaping, where a provider with a cheap internet access will have a lot of customers with a non-protected computer will favor quarantine measures. Egress filtering, it's less used than ingress filtering. And we were not sure about the reason of this. What we could ask you, it's does it mean that provider focus more on what they receive and trust their own network? About sending spam. According to an MSNBC report, some provider could turn a blind eye on spam if they could benefit from a financial point of view on it. If I quote the report, they said, engineers, abuse staff and technicians all want the spammer off the network, but you know, the sales staff are looking on the money. The origin of the spam is also something we can take in account. For example, in the spam house figures of October, we can see in the top 10 of the country sending spam that there is only one EU country, which is UK, ranking 7 and accounting for 4% of the spam sent by those 10 countries. In the other hand, if you look the figures from 10 micro about the spam received, in the top 10 of the country, you have 5 European countries, which means that we receive more than what we send. I should also mention that the figures varies a lot depending on the editors and on the company that give the figures. Then we have to take the figures very carefully. But a common trend that we have seen during the past 18 months, it's that the sending spam from botnet in the EU country is increasing. If we look at how many providers offer a spam protection, the figure is 81%. Free of charge and for an additional free fee. This figure is not as high as we expected it, but it's because around 15% of the provider reply that they do not want to interfere in their customer communication. And as you can see here, many provider provide a free of charge spam protection. Just a little summary on the study. Reporting is to some extent mandatory in the US, while it's not, while the reporting in EU countries is mostly on a voluntary basis. Many problems go unnoticed, and security decisions are made without accurate data. We think that Europe needs a warning mechanism to identify and address upcoming threats. Most providers follow a so-called industry best practice, and providing are doing a lot, but could improve customer confidence, for instance, by showing compliance with security certificates. Provider sees a conflict between delivering secure service and protecting privacy. The opinion 118 of the Article 29 Working Party on Privacy help finding the right balance between these conflicting goals. Still, the cost of widespread and customized filtering is prohibitive, and a further dialogue is necessary between privacy and security proponents. About the measure to fight spam, there is many. For example, OECD anti-spam toolkit. We have seen code of conduct for providers. There is sender authentication technique that will be presented later. There is fine for spammers and many initiatives on collecting data on spam. But at the same time, we have heard also some providers saying that they fear of counter lawsuit from spammers. Then they sometimes don't blacklist some spammer because they are afraid of doing some such kind of action. And we can also say that still today, the economic model of spam is still valid. You can find the two reports on these links, and on the second one you will find some action that could be done at ENISA level or member state level or provider level. Questions are welcome. Yes?
Just a quick question. You said that 1% wished they could do more. Do you have any breakdown about what the reasons were for not? Was it legal reasons? Was it sales?
No, we didn't ask, and they didn't give more detail on this. It could be a lack of resource, but it's just guessing. We have no concrete information on this. Another thing that I could add also is that we are thinking to continue working on this. Then if you want to collaborate next year, please fill our questionnaire. It will help us to have a better idea on what you are doing and how.
Just one question.
Yes?
This will help with Andy. The people who said they were afraid of retaliation, you said that some people were afraid that spammers would attack them.
Yes.
Did they have any sort of evidence that this would happen or had happened?
Yes.
On ISPs?
Yes.
Okay. Can you say anything about that?
Yes, it was during MAG conference. We discussed with other with provider. They were, if I remember well, mostly US and Canadian providers. Then probably it's different for a European provider, but I don't know where provider in this room are from. But it could be that the legal things are different. But they clearly said that they got some problem with lawyers, and now that they don't do it again.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for that, Pascal. Okay. Thank you for your help. Okay. All right. Probably. Thank you. Thank you. And. We will make sure these URLs are available directly, but of course the presentation is up in the meeting web pages already, so that's good. Thank you for that. And yes, Elliot, would you like to come and find your place? Are they alphabetical?
Yeah.
Should be called Lee or something. Here we go.
Can I use the?
Of course, no. Jump around.
Yeah, frenetic.
Elliot Lear, some of you may know, he comes from Cisco, in one sense. He is well up with the DKIM initiative, and there's a working group on the IETF, which I'm sure he'll be telling you about. If there's anybody who really has never heard of DKIM before, then you're welcome to ask. But it starts with domain keys, and it's about sender authentication, or sender identification anyway. And there's a little bit of background coming on what it actually does and what's underneath its skirts, but also a little bit of what it means and why we should bother. That's right. Thank you.
Hi. I'm Elliot. I'm representing a bunch of people who are working on DKIM, as we call it. Let me ask a question. How many people in the room are as providers run mail services? Okay. Well, I guess I won't be talking to the academic points then. Okay, this comes right out of the charter of this group. So part of the thing that this working group is supposed to do is develop a code of conduct to which ISPs might agree to adhere. It is foreseen that this document might be used as an indication that a signing party would make efforts to ensure that their customers are not responsible for abuse. And I'm going to stop reading from that point. The key words there are signing party. Well, I'm here to talk about signing parties, I guess. So true or false, we can eliminate spam through technical means. Anybody believe this? Okay. Good. false. But we can probably provide some means to reduce it. Here's another one. We can eliminate phishing through technical means. Anybody believe this? You should. Because I think we can. I'll come back to that at the end. I think that this is a gaping hole that I think the IETF is going to start working on. We actually have started working on it.
Quick question. When you say phishing, is that bank phishing or all phishing?
I think phishing meaning where somebody is enticed to enter their credentials into a site that's attempting to abscond with them. Okay. I mentioned that I might be a little provocative. Towards the end, if we have some time, I'll take a stab at that one, because I think the IETF and other organizations should be doing more, and I think they are, and W3C will be. Okay, so what DKIM is not? DKIM is not a replacement for PGP or S/MIME. It really offers it binds no responsibility to the actual sender of a message. If you want that sort of assurance that the person who wrote the message is the sender, then you should be thinking about this. It also provides limited lifetime keys. There's no non-repudiation in DKIM. This is not an attempt to recreate all of that. The other thing is that DKIM is not a path-based authentication mechanism. That's by design. Anybody who's familiar with SPF or sender ID, those are more path-based approaches, and the DKIM people took another path, as it were, because they didn't think that the path of the network should matter, and I agree with that. And DKIM does not say whether or not a message is or is not spam. All it does is one of two things. So it's domain keys identified mail, it's a signature-based approach, it's transparent to the end users, and all it does is it says that this domain, this piece of email, came from or was authorized by a particular domain administrator. It has three key components: the signature in the message. This is the MTA signs the message. A public key in DNS, so you can verify a signature, and then a signing practices record, which indicates what happens if the message isn't signed, pretty much, and who can sign these messages. So this is like hopefully my one graphic, but it doesn't look like it's going to work, because there should be like a person here and a person there where the X is. This is a Mac to PC thing. We have technical assistance on the spot. Otherwise, I could do a very good graphical description with my hands and maybe, you know, with, you know, like the monitor there.
Two volunteers.
Yeah. There we go. Bob and good old Bob and Alice. If we can believe that they're them.
Because we overrun these play.
So while he's doing that, I'll just talk about what happens. So the user, you have two users, Bob and Alice. We'll take those examples. When Bob sends a message, he's sending it to his service provider or to some SMTP, MSA, or MTA. Presumably, at this point in time, he's authenticating to that MSA or MTA. And from that point, the MSA or MTA can then decide whether or not it wants to sign the message. If it's not going to sign the message, you know, chances are it's not going to send the message because it probably didn't authorize, it probably wouldn't have authorized the communication and it would look an awful lot like an open relay. Once the message is signed, it gets sent to Alice's MX. And from that point, Alice's MX can do a couple of things. It can ship the message off to, say, a reputation service and say, is this guy really Bob? Does Bob's domain send a lot of spam or anything like that? I think we're on one more there. Oh, hey, cool. Look, it's even animated in everything. So I think we're just about here. So let me, actually, I skipped a step. Like, I skipped the whole DKIM step. That was sort of bad. Okay, so the message gets to the destination MTA, this guy. And what happens next is that this guy then does a DNS query over to the sending domain, that's this, and then you notice there's a selector underbar domainkey.originator.com, which he then gets a response and can check the signature of the message that was just sent. That's pretty much DKIM in a nutshell. Okay. So the rest of this is not DKIM per se, but you could do things like ask the question, is this message spam? You know, you could do things like if you're Goodmail or something like that, or if you're Spam House, you might want to collect information like this and determine who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. You can't determine who the good guys are or who the bad guys are if you're not sure that you're talking to a good guy, if you can't identify the originator. We're giving you some means to identify the originator. Okay, finally, this person pops, Alice pops her email down, or IMAPs her email down, and she could make the same checks too. It's not like it has to be done at the MTA or the MSA. It could be done in the UI. We think it's best at least indicated in the MTA, in the last top MTA, so that you can collect some additional information. And this is where everybody's anti-spam software is already today. So you could easily imagine some work going into, say, even public domain tools like Spam Assassin to take advantage of this sort of mechanism. And by the way, if you notice, Google and I think some other mail providers are beginning to get a little bit more savvy about who they're accepting mail from. And they're looking for, I think Google in particular right now, they're looking at SPF and they're also looking at DKIM. And if you don't have an MX, if a mail comes from an MTA that does not either have an MX record pointing to it or an SPF record pointing to it, Google sort of says, no, you know, I don't believe that you're a real mailer. So here's what it looks like in the header. It's really ugly. This is not a perfect DKIM message. Some stuff has changed in the final draft. There's two separate signatures now, one that covers the body and the other that covers the header. Just a little bit of an explanation. We have an algorithm indicator. There's actually a query mechanism indicator, length. T and X are actually debugging information. here's, if you remember the selector in the domain lookup, that's this, and the whole idea of the selector is that you should be able to roll your keys over if you want to without having to use DNS semantics. And then what's signed, in this case, the content type, the from, the subject, the content transfer encoding, MIME version, what domain signed it, and who is and who was authenticated, and the from and the subject line are copied because they tend to get munged fairly fair amount. And then finally, we have the signature, and this is the actual header from a real message. So, and then in DNS, here's what it looks like again. So here we have the selector again. This is the thing, if you want to roll a key, you just modify the selector and then publish that. The actual public key, and currently all this stuff is in TXT records. The record lengths, I think if I remember the draft correctly, are at 512, but it could be 256, or the key lengths rather. Obviously over time, we're going to need to increase those key lengths. So if we get to a point where they increase too much, we won't be using text anymore. So what's done? The first thing is I actually was slightly inaccurate in the message I sent you, Rodney. The draft has been approved by the IETF working group. It's now just completed, as I understand, the area director review, and is now going to go to IETF wide last call, where I imagine we'll see some fireworks. But I expect it to pass. Implementation has been done for SendMail. There's some Milter out there. There's a Deakin consortium that is actually building some products. And there's a lot of stuff that's done that people use the earlier version of domain keys that you'll see signed from a message standpoint. And actually, an earlier draft of DKIM is also out there quite a bit. What's not done? The sender signing practices records, we're still getting our hands around what that should look like. There's a requirements effort that's going on in DKIM. And as we speak now, in 2 hours, there's actually a Jabber session that the DKIM working group will be going over to continue looking over requirements for the sender signing. And the idea is, if you're a big organization and people sign on your behalf, do you need to indicate that, or do you just have a selector? How do you manage the keys? There are a lot of operational best practices that we need to sort through, and I think a lot of that relates to sender signing practices. So there will be, I think, an effort to cut over to the new version of the document, also that the new version of the DKIM base spec that you'll see as well. I think reputation services need to make use of the identities, but before that, we need to see a lot more in the way of deployment. Some of the big ISPs in America are doing something akin to this, and I think you're going to begin to see it when the reputation services see that they can actually distinguish things that aren't spam from are spam by using this. And I guess people probably recall when SPF was put out, I don't know if anybody remember, who were the first people to use it?
Spammers.
Bingo, spammers. So we expect the same thing with DKIM too. The only issue is whether or not we can get enough legitimate people to implement this that it'll matter. Otherwise, you could just use the DKIM to spot the spammers, I guess. In my opinion, we also need to continue to improve authentication and security practices. How many people have dealt with enterprises that are just riddled with bots? Okay, one. In my opinion, that's a major source of spam. And in order to solve that, you need to improve the internal security of those customers, of their PCs and their authentication mechanisms. Right now, right, if you get one of those enterprises riddled with some sort of a virus, they can just go sending mail to the local MSA, and if they don't have, if their password's been snarfed, or the user's password's been snarfed, then the MSA doesn't know that, so it's just going to sign the message. So DKIM is necessary, but not entirely sufficient on its own. Yeah. Okay, that's it. Questions?
Okay, just pass it.
Carsten Strottmann, Men and Mice. I've seen in the DNS record that there are semicolons as separators, which needs to be escaped.
They are escaped.
Yeah, is that mandatory? Because what we see is that a lot of people trying to include SPF in their domains, and which are not DNS experts, they break their zones by doing something wrong. I fear that with these semicolons, a lot of people will just don't know that they need to be escaped and will break the DNS zones by trying to enter DM.
I think you're asking a very reasonable question, and asserting a very reasonable point. The issue I have is actually greater than that, which is having to do something at all with DNS for many administrators is a challenge. And so there are going to need to be some tools, I think, to do the key management. And maybe they're public domain, maybe they're not. But like if you look at DNSSEC, for instance, in the bind distribution, there are some tools available to do the zone signings. You don't actually enter those records yourself. I don't foresee people actually entering the records themselves to do this. I think over time they just have a script or two that generates them based on a domain.
Yes, but I don't see these tools emerging so fast.
Yeah, the standard's still barely, well, it's not even a standard yet. So,
because spam is such a pressure, as soon as people realize that there's something new that might stop some spam, they start adopting it. We see that with SPF, and a lot of people like from Macintosh community that are not aware how to work on the command line, they break their zones with that.
So I think if you'll send me an email, actually, I might toss together something in Perl just to do this, just that people can generate this stuff.
Okay.
Because it isn't that hard in terms of producing the public key, and then the MSA needs the private key anyway, and that needs to go into a configuration file. And it's going to vary depending on what your MSA is. If you're using Postgres or if you're using SendMail, there are obviously going to be two different mechanisms. And if you're using something else, then there's going to be something else for that.
Okay. Good.
I believe we will answer the question.
Okay.
Roland Perry, you said you would perhaps go back to the issue of the phishing.
Sure, sure.
One of the things I'm not quite clear about is how does this address the issue of people phishing from a domain that they've recently set up that's got a name that sounds a lot like the one they're phishing?
Oh, you mean like a homeoglyph or something like that?
Or just something like mybank-customerservices.com.
Sure, I totally understand. DKIM doesn't do a thing for that, in my opinion. What needs to be done there is we need to improve mechanisms of authentication on the web. So I'll give you a couple examples of some of the stuff that's being thought about at the IETF. One of which is a neat hack by some people at Stanford, I think it's Stanford, who it's called P-Word, I think it is, is what they called it in their paper, but don't hold me to that, where what you do is you hash the password, your password, against the domain name of the destination site. And this is just an example. There are many other approaches that could be considered, but they're all technically feasible. And the idea is your real password never goes across the wire. All right? So if that homeoglyph-like name gets your password, it's going to hash differently. All right? So it's going to look different. So unless you register on that site for something and then provide personal information, then the risk is limited to registration, not to theft of the password. That's something I think we can accomplish fairly easily. And then I think that there is a portion of phishing we probably can't fix. And that portion is if the person gets tricked into providing like credit card information without having logged in to a site that they've registered, that problem is more difficult to solve.
Right? Can I? I can see where you. Oh, go on then, Brian. Yeah, go on.
Brian Nisbet. So, all this work is being put in, and to another way of
saying that this email came from this domain. And one of the things I've never really got a decent answer to in all the stuff I've read on this is, what makes this different? Why will this succeed where SPF hasn't? Why will this not just be used by the spammers in the way it was? You know, what? Okay, we can see how this works, but what's it actually going to do?
I think SPF and DKIM are two sides of the same coin. It's just a matter of which technology you believe is better and more scalable. And I can see arguments for either side. The IETF has chosen to standardize on DKIM, and there are actually companies that are putting resources and effort into limiting, into actually signing their mail and actually reading the signatures. So Yahoo and Google actually do look at the signatures. Whether or not that expands outward, I don't know. Google, as I mentioned, is already taking defensive steps based on whether or not a message is sent from a system that is either in an SPF record or is in an MX record, the old VXE hack, as I like to call it. So already we see a major email provider doing something. Will the other email providers do it? I don't know. I like to think so, because I believe that the spam problem is a pretty big problem. It's a pretty big social problem, and it's a waste of resources. And quite frankly, my biggest concern is that it degrades the confidence in the internet. And so I think that there is a motivation for people to want to fix it, but that's my own personal opinion. So I don't know if that'll satisfy you. I doubt it. I think time is the only thing that's going to satisfy you on that answer.
A similar sort of question. You mentioned Yahoo, you mentioned Google.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't mention MSN, who are at the moment plowing a different furrow.
Mm-hmm.
How is sort of acceptance among the big players going?
Well, I did mention Yahoo, I did mention Google. There are a couple of other players out there who
AOL and MSN would be the obvious next one.
Microsoft in particular is still promoting sender ID, but they haven't exactly said, no, we're never going to do DKIM. I think they would like to see sender ID take off. They're sort of the elephant in the room in one regard, right, because they have a huge installed base. But that installed base doesn't necessarily cover, for instance, the service provider POP and IMAP infrastructure. So Sendmail Inc. Is heavily involved in this. Eric's name is top on the draft on this. So Eric Allman, the author of Sendmail, is the one who's done the editorial work as well as a good portion of the authoring. And so it's not like there's nobody involved. I think there's a considerable consortium. I didn't put it on my slides here. Maybe I'll give you an update to those slides if you like, with a couple of URLs that indicate who all is involved. But right now there are about 20-25 companies that are interested and engaged, and along with the IETF.
Right. And when you say they're interested, you mentioned that Google and Yahoo are checking for signings.
Well, they're right now they're using domain keys, which is the predecessor.
Yeah, yeah, all right. Mm. But that puts them in line for doing it properly, doesn't it?
Certainly, yeah, I would think so. I think it's a matter of time, and the issue that we have from a standardization standpoint is, until the specification is absolutely finalized, you don't want to have three standards out there in the field. You're better off having as few as possible, because we're going to have two for at least some period of time, which is and in fact we have two already. Some people are doing DKIM, some people are the first draft, some people are doing domain keys. So you want to limit the interoperability experiments to a certain extent.
Peter Koch. It just struck me, because you twice now said that the IETF is going to standardize and so on and so forth. I just wanted to point out that the working group, the DKIM working group, might actually be very happy with all these solutions, and one of these documents is on its way to the ISG already, I guess. Yeah. But there are other parts of the ITF that still might have some... So I'm going to avoid the word problem and not say it.
Or you some, can say it.
Some issues with the use of the infrastructure, and especially that part that is present on the slides in capital letters. So just to remind everyone that that is not a done deal completely. So the base spec is done, but I guess there are some issues regarding infrastructure in SSP. Still to be worked on. And apologies for missing the previous part of your...
Okay, so let me just repeat two things. First, the base spec needs to be finalized by the IESG. What I said at the beginning was that I expect some fireworks in that process. But Elliot's personal opinion is that it will go through relatively unscathed at this point because the battles have largely been fought. The second point is that while SSP needs a lot of work, in my opinion, the document itself is, the base spec itself is useful in and of itself for most domains without SSP. And you can check a signature. The question is, what do you do with a mail that's unsigned?
Exactly, yeah.
In those cases. And if your domain is signing everything, then that's an easy one, right? And then one of the things you could do today, for instance, is if you apply this to Spam Assassin, you would up the score for something that may be unsigned for a domain that you're expecting it to be signed. But that doesn't mean you indicated it's spam. You up the score.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that this... Well, you mentioned that you expect it to be signed, and that thing that's actually feeds your expectation, that is what needs to be specified in the SSP part, right?
Right.
And that is that may have or may not have, depending on the solution, the interesting effect on the infrastructure.
Yeah, DNS is a pretty good infrastructure for this. The information that we're talking about is highly read optimized, so I don't expect there to be a major issue with the use of DNS for this. You know, it's almost a perfect use of DNS in my opinion. But the thing I think will be more interesting is what actually is in the record, what actually is in the SSP record, whether or not there's actual third party signing, which is really where the debate is right now, is whether or not, you know, if you have a marketing company that's signing stuff on your behalf to send to customers, whether or not you need to indicate that specially. I think once we get over that question, most of the rest of this just, you know, settles out. So my guess, if I had to predict, it's really hard to predict the IETF's timelines because the IESG works in mysterious ways sometimes, but I foresee that the DKIM draft will probably be approved by the end of the year. The base draft will be approved by the end of the year is my guess. And I suspect that this time next year we'll have the SSP finished and approved as well. But that's Elliot's guess.
Excuse me if you explained that before, but why is there an underscore in the domain name? I thought underscores were illegal.
Exactly for that reason, because they're reserved, not illegal.
Reserved?
Yes. This has been reviewed by the DNS directorate.
They are not reserved, but let's not go into this. We can take this offline.
Okay.
There is no reservation whatsoever. It's just a convention, but I can explain.
Okay. Yeah, but the DNS people have reviewed this. That was part of the discussion about whether or not we need a record of our own. And the initial answer was no, but we may yet at some point.
Could you please strike why is this much better than SPF? Because, well, it's much more complicated, that's for a fact. And I personally don't see a lot of prongs, process when compared to SPF.
So the question is whether it is really, what it boils down to is, do you prefer a path-based approach, or do you prefer something where you don't have to worry about the path of the message, but you just worry about the origin and the destination? And there are a lot of reasons why a message could be intercepted in the middle by either an MX that is in the middle, or worse, what we see more of these days is, you know, some sort of proxy that is just passing the message through. One of the goals of DKIM, for instance, is if you go through a mailing list reflector, if the message remains untouched, the message can be, the signature can be left intact and you can still verify the from line. Things get a lot more complex if you are using SPF, you go through a reflector. Now, if the user's trying to verify this information, the SPF information may or may not verify against, say, the from line, which is one of the things that you would sort of like it to do, because you want to know that the message came from the person who it says it came from. And that's one of the benefits, I think, of DKIM versus SPF. The limitation of that benefit is a lot of mailing list software does modify the message. So that's one of the reasons why they've duplicated the from and subject line in the DKIM header, so that that information is preserved, so that you can say, yeah, this did come from this guy, and here's the signature on the body may or may not match because the mailing list dinked with it, but in fact the mailing list can then re-sign it, so you get both. And this leads into some interesting UI questions down the road, in my opinion, as to how a UI is going to represent both signed and unsigned messages. So I'm not a UI guy. I'm not going to go there with you, but I can see that those problems are there. Other questions?
People stirring. Okay, just going back to the sort of big picture of this, it's a piece of technology. It does something. You've pointed out, as everybody does, it doesn't fix spam. Spam is, of course, what people want fixing. What's missing?
Well, it's, as I say, I think it's necessary but not sufficient. The sufficient portion would be to have some sort of a couple of key points. Having those best practices that you're working on here, and then having mechanisms to indicate whether or not a site is following those best practices. Now, we have something that is roughly equivalent to that through in sort of the reverse, right? If you look at Spam House or the other DBLs, that's exactly what they're doing in reverse, right? They find bad actors and they list them. We just need something that finds good actors and lists them, because really that's what you need.
Okay.
The whole thing about spam, right, is it boils down to this question. What do you do with a message from a person you don't know? Right. Everything else is easy. You can whitelist to your heart's content. That's the tough problem is, what do you do with a message from a person you don't know? And that's what this is meant to address.
That's a fair comment. And I have one more. Given that everybody understands its limitations, but also what it does do for you, you've referred several times to little scraps about deployment. What do you think the prospects are for deployment to such an extent that people can actually say it does something?
This is
it's not quite the same question as I asked before.
So I think it's a tough question, right? Because if I wanted to put my DKIM marketing hat on, I would simply say go implement it and this won't be a problem, right? Because everybody, the more, if it snowballs and you get enough implementations out there, then people will just do this and you have identification. What is the trigger to do that? I think it's when people get fed up with getting too much crap in their mailbox. And this is a reasonable approach to getting those mechanisms in place. It's just, I can't say what's going to trigger.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much, Eddie.
Okay, thank you.
That's good.
This one, right? Thank you.
Right, tiny bit of stage management now. Not to mention getting dressed again. Probably do. Okay. Do I press the top button? Thank you. You are here? that's okay. We're slightly ahead of time. I'm sorry about that, but it's just you've got to take the smooth with the rough. And so just going on through, there are a couple of dummies here, some of which we've missed out by mistake, and it doesn't matter too much. Now, the other kind of thing that we commonly do here is to, you know, just sort of review what the world is like, and this quite often turns up some surprising and often rather disappointing things, so try and look for some encouraging ones. A bit further on, I do want to spend a few minutes just talking about the only published right document about this, so I will take that a bit further on. What's been happening in the evil world recently? I've just made up a few things there. Usually I can put down better social engineering because the bad guys do get better at it. Or maybe we just get more stupid, I don't know, but it seems to work like that. So, you know, everybody's been talking about what phishing does to you. It doesn't look the same every week, and that's the whole point. It doesn't look the same every week, and there seem to be new people to be able to pick it up and keep the fishers in business. Anybody want to say anything spectacular about phishing this week? Last week? Keith, do you want a microphone?
Just a brief one, really. I heard last week of a new initiative called fishtank.com, which is a mechanism for reporting phishing scandals, phishing scams, and potentially collating the information to improve detection of them in future. That's all.
Okay, is that, do you know who the initiative was from?
It's from OpenDNS.
Okay. Does anybody know how it works or any more about it? I haven't heard of this.
That's all I know, and I'm not advocating or endorsing this service in any way. I'm just saying that I know it exists.
That was enough. Thank you. That's what my question was. Does anybody actually know any more than that? Well, there you are. There's homework. I'm sorry about that. Law enforcement and banks, of course, are desperately interested in phishing, and they all have very different, slightly off the point ways of dealing with it. They will pick out one aspect of it which is critical to them. Go on.
Yeah, if you're just doing, Malcolm Hutton here from Lynx. If you're just doing trend watching, one thing that at least in the UK we've been noticing is what appears to be a significant rise in targeted phishing, i.e. where the phisher is not aiming just en masse at the general public, but have actually got an organisation that they are targeting to extract passwords from that set of users, from an identified set of users.
When you said targeted, and the answer to this might be yes, do they also have some information sort of derived from inside, from the organisation that makes it work better?
I remember, although certain types of information don't have to be derived from inside. You can guess what would be useful to, what might be attractive to users at that organisation, just from open source methods, and then try and direct them to a site that would be particularly likely to get password information out of them.
Okay. Any more? Are there any countries that are immune from phishing or particularly exposed to it? I've forgotten now who was giving the talk in the plenary. List of banks. Sorry, Scott. I just couldn't remember who it was. Yeah.
Makes it easy to say yes.
That's right. There was a list, and I thought when you put up your first page, that's awesome. Terrible. That's us. And then the next page, I thought, oh no, it's everybody else as well. You get carried on. Not obvious to me. Is it obvious to you that there's any particular culture is being
picked? The ones whose authentication mechanisms are not particularly sophisticated. They don't use one-time password schemes. It's a simple sign-in, username, password. And those largely come from North America and Asia and a few other locations like that. European banks seem to be less commonly targeted because they seem to have multi-factor authentication instead of Doesn't make them impervious, but it just means less is what we consider.
Okay, so for anybody who's only listening by microphones, it's mostly North America and Asia, and Europe is relatively, is a bit further down the list. That's what comes.
And something which occurred to me just then was, and also Malcolm saying about targeting, I get an awful lot of phishing emails, you know, several hundred a day. I don't think I've ever seen one that wasn't in English. But maybe that's just me.
Okay. No, okay, so it's not just an English language. Well, I don't know. Peter, were you going to say something about that?
No, I was just going to confirm that it's
also. So, I mean, I don't know whether the gentleman was going to refer to various versions of non-English, because much of the English label is also not English. But there's definitely spam targeted at the particular bank. So we have a couple of banks in Germany, for example, that are, or bank chains, so to speak, whose customers are targeted by that. And that is, increasingly good German, so to speak.
Okay, so this is the, Marco was coming back, the social engineering trick.
Sorry, when I was talking about targeting, I wasn't referring to targeting in sending it out to everyone in the hope that you'll get customers of a particular bank. I meant things like targeting it at the employees of that bank. So this spam goes to the employees of a particular bank or other organization in an attempt to extract passwords specifically from them.
Oh, interesting. I'd never heard that before. Interesting. Okay. Back to the sort of email abuse. So there's a sort of financial abuse there and a cultural abuse. The email abuse is really not much different from any other email abuse. It all goes out through bots like any other bulk mail, unless anybody knows differently. Scott does know differently.
Scott McIntyre. Just to say, we didn't specifically mention it, but advanced fee fraud, 419 type scams are also definitely on the increase, certainly for us. We're seeing them in multiple languages, multiple character sets, and so on. It's sort of an element of all of these aspects. I was at a really interesting meeting, a sort of an expert meeting here in the Netherlands, which brought together the financial services industry, law enforcement providers, telcos, and so on, and their view of certain countries, which start with an N and end with Nigeria, is not particularly good. Indeed, one international telco provider said, don't bother taking your GSM phone to this country or expect any phone calls to or from them because we blacklist that country. In terms of email abuse, we are seeing that these people don't need and are not currently using bots to get their message out. They've got their spamware, they go to the internet cafes, they just go ahead and send it out directly. They don't actually use these massive bot armies yet in any wide scale, unless anybody else is seeing differently.
Okay, is anybody seeing differently? I had a slightly different impression of it. I haven't traced stuff back. I enjoy throwing it away more than I enjoy looking at it, so that's what happens usually. But the Nigerians, it's certainly true that Nigerians have wonderful internet cafes, but not all this, so far as I can see, comes from Nigeria in any sense.
No, as a matter of fact, the Netherlands is one of the top Netherlands countries source.
With the next one I thought of. Yes, that's right.
Yes, we're number one.
You are, you see. Got to be first in something. As we always say in Britain. Sorry.
That's a football reference.
All right.
Can I say something?
Of course, sorry. Something serious, you mean? That's right.
Nothing about Holland. I do remember an issue, I think it was late this spring, where actually, the Swedish bank is using two-way authentication with this magic little box, and you have actually to answer a challenge all the time for everything you're going to do. Which means this makes it a little bit harder to actually do a phishing issue with it, you know, an attack. But I think there was a case where they actually succeeded to do a man-in-the-middle attack, watching a connection, a live one. Because it's very hard to do it otherwise, you have to actually take certain steps. But there was a customer who actually got, he lost quite a lot of money that way. And it only could happen that the guy actually, the man in the middle was sitting and doing it at the same time. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting, and it's a lot of it's what happens when you apply a lot of technology to banking, as they like to do for various reasons. And the problem for consumers, and this of course is not email consumers, but doesn't matter, is that the stuff is supposed to be so good that the bank will go more firmly into denial than they were able to before. It's quite hard, I think, to get through that. Okay. Header forgery I've only included because headers, I really can't always tell now where the true headers run out and the lies begin. You know, sometimes it's obvious. It always used to be obvious, but it's not anymore. And, you know, it's not... If I was a spammer, I would have been doing that for a long time. It's not very difficult, but they have improved now. Even the timestamps are sometimes credible. I'm not sure about manipulation of bounces. What made me think of this was that some of the bits of social engineering arrive looking like a non-delivery report, and it's just a way, you know, it's just one more way of getting people to open a message. Whether people always think that male abuse folk are deliberately trying to generate bounces, and certainly they do generate bounces, but I don't think this is of any benefit to them unless I've missed something. I mean, you know, you can think of including something that would some sort of Trojan in the top half of a message that when it got bounced back to an innocent third party, they might conceivably be taken in by it, but it doesn't seem to me that that very often happens. Yeah, okay. Well, it could be just that. Okay. A lot of the GIF spams, you know, just image spams of various kinds, if you manage to stick with a non-graphical mail program, you don't actually... It's very irritating, but they're not a danger to you. They're a serious danger to quite a lot of other people. And with them, almost always, is, at least all the ones I've bothered to look at, is what I've just called sort of Bayesian blinding stuff. Really quite a lot of text that somebody with a graphical interface will never see. But it's then, because of that, it's possible to put in so much that the good points that you get in a Bayes estimate of it really outweigh the fact that it's a GIF. Well, go some way to outweigh the fact that it's a GIF. So that's a harder one to get round. At least I don't know how people get around it. Anybody else got a slightly different view on this? Roland, while you're getting there, Scott?
Just an observation. I don't know how strict one should be with one's suppliers, but I note that one of the e-commerce suppliers that I've recently signed up with sends me very graphical emails where they are broken in some way so that my text-only client won't read them at all, and I therefore either have to view the raw text, the very raw text, which my client lets me do, and then with great trepidation I say, well, maybe I'll point a browser at this and see if that looks right. But if people are sending broken messages like that, which you do probably want to read because you do want to see the bill that these people have sent you and how much they're going to knock off your credit card in 7 days' time, it just kind of lowers your resistance to opening graphical emails.
Interesting. Yeah. Anybody else seen that? It sounds as if it ought to be a solvable problem, but maybe not.
Over the last couple of months, we've seen a real rise of not just this Bayesian blinding, as you say, but where they're starting to use more and more keywords which get specifically through the sort of geek filters that most of us have. There's even been stories across the interweb over the last couple of days how they're throwing in more words, you know, firewall, antivirus, that type of thing, even program and code snippets. But on top of that, for the GIF content, we've also seen a rise of animated GIF and more bits of extra flex of colors and stuff so that you can't easily develop a simple signature or MD5 or SHA-hash of the image itself to get around that. That's almost exclusively pump and dump stock scam at the moment.
Okay. Any other evil things which weren't there once upon a time? We move on. What's happening in anti-abuse? Well, some people have been locked up. Some people have been fined. Not many, but then you don't need to lock up very many on the current belief. So that is happening, and I think we have to be, to be grateful for the more heavily resourced folk for actually sending out their lawyers and getting stuff done there. But some of these are actually criminal convictions, not just civil cases. And as Elliot, this is related to what Elliot was talking about. Really, SPF and sender ID, it's still there. I don't see it. I don't see it increasing. It has the same deployment problems as DKIM does. Every so often, you hear that Yahoo are or are not going to, to enforce a lot of policy with it. I don't think there's anything particularly new happening with that at the moment. It's a sort of Betamax situation. Something has got to suddenly appear to work and be picked up by everybody. It doesn't very much matter what it is. There are some problems with SPF, of course, but.
I just want to, Rodney, I just wanted to comment on one thing I said earlier. None of these things are going to happen overnight. It's going to take a while for anybody to do anything with either SPF, SID, or DKIM. So anybody who expects things to move faster than that, I mean, there's a huge infrastructure installed. So as I said, it's not a technical problem as much as it is a social problem and just migrating that infrastructure.
Yeah, I know, but I accept that whatever, it's not going to be, the problem is not going to be fixed in a year. But it could be that in a year, we've decided how we're going to fix it. Now, people have been saying that, some from Bill Gates upwards, for 2 years, have celebrated 2 years. So you've got to be careful what you say about this stuff. But yes, I mean, what I think a lot of us would like is for it suddenly to become obvious that if we do this, we can make email a better world. And that hasn't quite happened yet. That's really what I was getting at there. Okay, any other things that have happened in defences? Or, well, if you like, in the counter-attacks? Okay. Right. This is... You should be aware that there's this thing called the Internet Governance Forum. Everybody who talks to me about it says it's a very threatening object because it's going to somehow push control of some aspects of the Internet upstairs to people we really have very little influence on, direct influence on. In particular, they have an Athens meeting next month, I think it is, where they are determined to do something about this, among other things, to be fair, that's just one. One relevant sentence picked out, of course, and we should probably take an interest in it. I can't be more specific than that. RIPE NCC directly involved, Ron? Or taking interest?
Well, yes, I mean, the RIPE NCC is quite closely involved in this because this is a follow-on from the WSIS process, which really with an NRO hat on, the RIPE NCC was very much involved in. I, with my RIPE NCC government liaison hat on, have been to several of the planning meetings, two of the NRO CEOs are actually on the organising committee for the Internet Governance Forum in Athens, and so we do keep virtually a daily eye on it, and several of us will be going to Athens. I expect to be writing a report which will no doubt get circulated to the RIPE NCC membership in due course about what happened there. Well, I can speculate about what sort of event I think it is, what effect it will have on various communities, not just the internet community, but perhaps I should, as it's so close, perhaps I shouldn't do that. I did write a very small piece in the latest member update, which is available on the tables outside by registration.
Thank you. But don't go too far away, because it's not the one. Sorry, it's the next one. This one, I'm sure people have heard about this. AOL have suddenly started rejecting stuff. I think it's rejecting rather than bouncing, on the basis that you have included an IP address in the content, which, well, I do that all the time. Not to AOL people, to be fair, but It did seem a bit odd. I think they clawed it back, but have now claimed to have done it a bit better. And the most exciting thing I heard was that, I don't know what the parsing was, but a sequence of three dots, dot, 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 counted as an IP address in this context. This one, oh, sorry, James has something to say.
I was just going to say, an incentive to move to BSIS.
Okay, just don't ever put three colons in a row or something like that. Yeah, right. This looks quite interesting. Warren, do you want to say a few words? I mean, if not, I have summarized it and can say some more. While you do that, I'll walk across the room and pick up your...
Yes, this is... something that came out of our efforts to set up a government industry discussion on Monday afternoon, and one of the pieces of work which we had hoped that would be presented there, but unfortunately the gentleman was unable to make the journey down here to do it, revolves around some regulations which have actually been in force about 2 years now in Finland, which make certain provisions on ISPs. As you say, they're very, very broadly no open relays and SMTP to and from consumers, but perhaps not to and from business-to-business connections needs to be restricted in certain ways. That's, as far as I can tell, in order to monitor unusual traffic flows. In other words, somebody becoming part of a botnet or somebody just loading up some spamware and churning it out. Now, I don't really want to be in the situation of giving the gentleman's presentation for him. Hopefully, he may be with us in Tallinn to give his presentation there. What we're particularly interested in, and which I have no information about, is these regulations have been in force for 18 months or 2 years. What has happened? You know, how are they being monitored and policed? What does the local industry feel about their success, stroke their wisdom, and so on and so forth. I've left some copies of the regulations. I just printed some out today, but there's...
You can find them.
The URLs are there as well.
Roland, forgive me those URLs. The 2004 at the end of the top one is a confirmation that that's the year they came into effect. I'll just leave these on the front here. Clearly, you can read them just as well on the web, but... but it's interesting. It's not quite so fierce. Looking at it all, it seems quite balanced. There are two. No, I've said there. There are two documents. The bottom one actually spells out in detail pretty much what's in the top. It's not quite what I expected of a pair of documents. But you know, they do say that you really should block SMTP in both directions. And then the next paragraph says, but actually you might not want to. And it says things like that in quite a lot of places. Is anyone from Finland or near Finland who can comment on what this actually means every day?
No. Well, I'm from Finland, but for university, it doesn't affect us.
Okay, right. And did you know about this?
Yes.
Okay, right. So it has at least that much impact on daily life, but not much more, you think? Okay. And you don't think that that mail abuse has suddenly been eliminated, or was suddenly eliminated in 2004? Sorry to make you walk.
Well, in Finland, we've in practice have two major ISPs, so it's not a major issue. But if someone wants to provide mail service, this affects it. So, if you want to use mail service from another company, and then you buy your DSL from random ISP, then it affects
okay.
you from using your company resources or whatever.
Yeah, okay. Fair comment. Okay. Thank you. Something that's kept on coming up this week in various odd contexts and certainly in somewhat heated conversation with lots of people is how we do deal with rain. It's easy to say that... ordinary people really shouldn't be allowed direct SMTP. You know, their providers should just make it impossible, and a fair number of the problems we would see would become a little bit more manageable. Only, of course, when the rest of the world does the same. But it's the right thing to do in that sense. On the other hand, almost everybody who comes to a Right meeting is interested in not doing that. You know, we have funny things we do with our mail, and we would be grossly inconvenienced.
So there is, you know, there is a sort of dichotomy here. There's some conflict between what is right for it, and this is not condescending. There are a whole lot of people who don't care about this stuff, and they don't need to care about it. And my feeling is that actually we serve them better by not letting them tangle with direct SMTP. Just, it's a problem they haven't got. Whereas it seems to me entirely reasonable, and actually, to be fair, this is what the Finnish legislation might mean, that under some circumstances, if people need to do it, you can let them do it. It's not actually illegal. That I thought was quite constructive, but it's difficult to work out in practice. It's particularly difficult to get anybody to own up to it in a right meeting. Well, sorry, perhaps I'm cynical.
I forgot to present my the last speech. I'm Omar Andersson from Telesonera, Sweden. We had the same problem where actually blocking port 25 or not, you know. Of course, we like to have an open service, you know, with as little restriction as possible. But we decided to way back to block port 25 and open it to those customers who actually requested. And they signed a paper yesterday, so they showed they were responsible for whatever was passing through there. And it worked out good, you know, so there's a halfway solution to that issue, I believe.
Good. That's what I would like everybody to do.
That's a question for you, actually.
Yeah.
Yep.
How do you manage the scalability of provisioning for a customer?
That's a good question, because it only scales up to a certain bit. But if you look at it, this is most for residential customers, and it's hopefully the best view had been that we didn't have to block it at all, you know, but we had to do something about it. So it's like between a rock and a hard place in this issue. So that's the best way to go at the moment.
Thank you. Oh, another contribution. I shall move on before long. Yes.
Well, my name is Ernest Storm. I come from the Norwegian Telecommunication Authority. I just wanted to make a short comment on the legislation regarding spam. Currently, we are
doing... This is Norwegian legislation.
Yeah,
yes.
The Norwegian legislation. So, of course, it will only affect the Norwegian ISPs. But we are doing a precautionary change in the Norwegian Electronic Communications Act to have a clearer authority to actually put regulations in place regarding spam. But that is just a precautionary, because what we really want to do is actually invite the ISPs in Norway to produce best practices to follow. And that's what we have, well, probably it's gone out this week or next week, a letter with the invitation actually to produce such best practices. And of course, in that respect, in that context, the RIPE 206 document will be helpful input to such a process. And of course, I'm saying this because these best practices and legislation are sort of kind of tied together a little bit, because like also the ENISA study report also recommended to have best practices put in place, and also that was the recommendation for the OECD anti-spam task force, which we also attended together with our ministry. But as I said, the change in the legislation is just a precautionary to have a clearer authority to actually, if it proves necessary, to put such regulations in place.
Thank you. Right, we move on. I don't believe there's much to say here. I always have products there in case there are some magic bullets that you can buy that do it all, but there never are, that's right. List discussion, this is the anti-spam working group list, and not a lot of discussion, but Bill Stanley decided it was one of the places he could take out some venom on the spam house people. There are plenty of other places where he's done the same. It's tough being spam house. I don't think there's anything much to say about these that hasn't been said before. The more people can suppress bounces, the better the world is, but it's only a slightly indirect relation to the other things. Everybody has their own preferred filtering. Well, carry on, that's good. This one, I'm not quite clear what's
there's something to look out for in the database working group. There is an issue also that I haven't written down here that they have spotted, and if anybody knows a lot more about this directly than I do, then say so, that the abuse mailbox attribute, which was intended to make it possible to get a message to the right place, was quite, for quite good reasons, not added to the obvious things that you might have thought it was added to. Surprisingly, it's turned out to be optional in IRT objects, and most of them haven't got one, so that the that this quite nice hierarchical way of installing something at one place and having it inherited isn't actually getting deployed quite yet. So there are some issues in deployment there, but there's some work going on. Does anybody want to say anything as from that working group? It'll come up tomorrow. There's no problem. Okay. Not going to work too hard at this lot. We don't talk to marketers very much, or you have to think of that stuff, but I don't believe there's anything that needs to come up. I would like to do something about this one. This is a long-running saga. The intention is there'll be a short pause while you can look at something else for a minute. Just watch me make a mess, it'll be all right. Where I have a little bit more to say. This one. Takes a little while it winds up. There's a right document, which I can't remember the date of it, but it's a long time ago now. It was based on something that's ever so long ago, 7 years old. The links document, that's the London Exchange, which on which we based it, updated theirs 2 years ago, and we have been dragging our feet. I have been dragging my feet, so has everybody else, but I have, ever since. I believe it's appropriate now to essentially put up a replacement for Right 206, which is essentially the older one, which is pretty much the newer one. Now, I've put this out to the mailing list. We've talked about it lots of times. Unless anybody actually knows some reason why we shouldn't do that, apart from a couple of things I'll come to in a minute, then I believe I should just say to Right NCC, please put up this one, which is an alternative, a replacement for the other. Okay. So let me go through my little rigmarole. It doesn't take too long. I did mark up a draft. It's got pretty colours on it to show you where the new bits are and things. This is actually... I've put it up again today, so it's in this meeting's documents. It just looks like a load of text with funny pink and yellow patches. It's all right. The things I've been through this before as well. Those are the new things it says. If you've only just arrived at this, then it's probably not worth reading that in detail, but it's all there. Okay. It all looks a bit old-fashioned now, but I know that's what we're coming to, really. But for the moment, I believe the right thing is just get on and put this thing up and not worry about the fact that we could have put something better up. We will do that as well if possible. Okay. Because if we do this, then... I think we can do it with a lightweight process and just do it. And the other things might come later. And they come in three layers, well, two layers really. We can either tweak it substantially, or we can say this is now the wrong document. We need a new one. And people have mentioned the value of BCP and this sort of stuff. So, some investment might be reasonable. That's just a summary of what I've done. It's not exciting at all. A couple of people suggested small things on the mailing list, and I've actually included some of them and said to the others that I've ruled some out because they would be significant changes or they would delay it, and I believe we ought to just do this one and perhaps do different things in another document. So we have two processes there. On the whole, if nobody objects today very much, then we can just do this. And unfortunately, if somebody does say they don't like it today, then the process is rather longer. And although I've optimistically estimated about 8 weeks, in practice it's nearer 19, I think. We don't want to go there with this one, really. so that's my... Well, actually, that is where I want to go at the moment.
if anybody wants to talk about this, I really don't expect anyone wants to talk about it much, but if you do, please say so. Right. I don't know if there are any other views that are worth canvassing. Is there anybody who really thinks even this is not worth doing? Okay. I think I'm glad you agree with my assessment of the balance between effort and benefit. That's fine. Is there anybody who wants to do anything different at all, just at the moment, just about this one? Okay. Well, I think I can reasonably say that there's been consensus on the mailing list and consensus here, and that's all I need to be able to say. Thank you. Just looking ahead in the remaining 0 minutes before tea, we might really think about doing the job properly, but it's not a trivial job. It's really quite hard, and one of the, there's the kinds of thing we might think about. The problem has moved on, it's 2 years, the problem really has moved on, and some of the solutions and the good practice have moved on as well. That was a very English document, an English document, I have to say. Quite nicely written in some places, and those of you who know the people who wrote it will understand, but probably not helpful, and this is occasionally commented on. We ought to have something that's simpler and doesn't do beautiful things, but does straight things and works better for people whose natural language is not fancy English. Sorry, Nigel. I don't think there's anything about the right community that makes a difference, but you have to think about that stuff. And are there things that just don't need saying any longer? Is it worth talking about open relays? You don't have to answer that question. It's just something to think about. I'm not going to answer it either. Okay. And if we do a complete rewrite, some of the same questions apply, but we've actually got structural things. What kind of document are we going to write anyway? Should it just be two pages with loads of pictures of people throwing things at each other, or what sort of thing should we be doing? And the target audience, that's quite an important one down there. Who is this thing for? Is it for big ISPs who don't want to hear from us, perhaps? Is it for small ISPs? Is there an element of it that's for consumers or users of medium-sized ISPs? And stuff like that. I think that's the end of what I put there. Oh, no, that's all right. Oh, yes. And the caution is that, there's a lot of work. A lot of people have tried to write BCPs. None of them have quite just taken off and been the one thing you say to everybody everywhere that this is where it says you shouldn't be doing this or you should be doing something else. So it's probably a more difficult job than you might think, which is what I've said. And I keep putting this little comment on the end. Whatever we do, we owe it to the links to entitle them to put it up as a document of theirs as well. That's the end of that one. That's okay. Perhaps this will just get something. Oh, no, it goes away. That's all right. Sorry, excuse the messy screen. I'm not going to propose just at the moment anybody has to volunteer to get that done, but it needs thinking about. And I think I should put some stuff around on the mailing list and see how much support I can get for perhaps doing it properly. Okay. Malcolm, you're going to say? Going to walk or have this?
Yeah, I think I can help with this outer band, but essentially just to note that there were a number of organisations now which are taking the existing right BCP and holding that up as this is what the industry did in Europe, at least, as a model of good practice. I'm thinking of the OECD, I'm thinking of the London Action Plan, which has got like 30 countries involved, anti-spam enforcement agencies, and others. I can't drop them all off the top of my head, but they do exist, and probably when RIPE 206 gets updated, it would be probably a good idea to let them all know proactively.
Thank you. If you've got a list, then we'll talk about it. That's right. Thank you. Thank you on that one. Any other business? Oh, yes, please. Adele, do come to the microphone.
I was just waiting for this part. two things. The first is about the IGF. You talk about the workshop on the spam. thing.
Right.
I have the bad luck to be a member of the IGF advisory group. So we are working now on the panelists to that workshop on spam and security. So if any of you feel comfortable to participate and be part of the panel, feel free either to contact somebody at RIPE or contact me directly with a brief resume on yourself and you're willing to participate. That's the first thing. The second thing is about Afrinic upcoming meeting. We have set aside one afternoon for tutorial, and one of the subjects which come often is about spam and phishing and email security issue. We are still looking for probable candidate for those tutorials. So if you are interested, contact me or go to the Afrinic website. There is a call for proposal to do the tutorial. So you're welcome. Thanks.
It's good. Form an orderly queue. The address to contact will be in the minutes. I don't think we've got time to do anything brand new about this. We always have to think about this. The one that perhaps does need looking at is if anybody has anything they'd like to offer at the next RIPE meeting in Tallinn, then I would like to hear about it sooner rather than later. And not necessarily now. Is there anything else anybody wants to say? Then there is one, sorry, don't go. Thank you.
I think there was supposed to take up a little bit earlier about legal cases and spammers, but I know some of you maybe is aware of David Leinhart of 360 Insight, that he dragged a spam house to a court in Illinois two times before, and he actually was at it again yesterday. This time he's trying to actually get the judge to suspend the domain spamhouse.org. Because the previous rulings was that I think they have to force him to take away the listing and the Roxo and so on, but as American legislation doesn't rule over UK one, so. But this one is a little bit serious because, I mean, the .org registry is, I believe, located in the States, so it could be a little bit serious. And of course, and he added to that as well that it should be illegal for any US citizens or company to use the spam house listing system. And by the way, has anyone else that seen this spam house lawsuit that's been circling around? It's a mail that's been sent out saying that they tried to actually scramble people to actually sue the spam house, because I received that one as well.
Yes, I've seen some of those.
I don't know who's behind it, but I can take a wild guess.
That's right. Yeah. The spam houses are clearly under attack, as they always have been. But it reminds me of what happened to Maps. I know the world was a different place then, but they were waiting to be attacked. And actually, when a real attack came, it was the things had moved on, and they couldn't cope with the attack that actually happened. Spam houses differently made, and I still can't see how it's going to be easy for the moment, and I think spam house deserve anything any of us can give by way of support.
That last news was very interesting, and I hadn't heard it before. The thing about getting the domain name suspended. Now, I can understand why spam house would still not want to go into an American court, given that their position is lack of jurisdiction. However, if some foolish American judge might be persuaded to go down this line, the implications will be much bigger than just the spam house, much bigger than just for anti-spam or anything like that. It would be a serious issue in the whole internet governance discussion. With that in mind, I don't know if anybody here is able to help make this happen, but I imagine that if the US Department of Commerce were aware of this, they might be prepared to enter an amicus curiae brief on the matter.
And you can spell that for the minutes. Thank you. It's fine. Okay. Right, sorry, keeping you from tea. Thank you very much for coming and for talking, lots of people. Thank you very much to the people who came, especially to present. It's very nice. That's it. See you next time.
Well, you and I are going to have a difference of opinion.
I guess
the RFCs say one thing, but VIXI's implementation says another. And that's what people VIXI's live up in digital. A bind. Well, try putting an underscore to bind in a host file on bind.
No problem.
You won't listen.